All right. Well, here we are. And I'm kind of glad we are where we are because everybody's going to be sleepy this afternoon and we get to listen to God. So just let me say, y'all need to pay attention because we're just really mostly going to look at the words that God said. So it's not me so much as God that we will hear this afternoon. Well, Elihu has discussed thunderstorms in his discussion of God Almighty, and Job, as he ponders and contemplates the power of the thunderstorm, God himself, God, Jehovah and Lord, is rolling his very self up in a storm. In the 38th chapter, we will begin to look at a couple of chapters in this wonderful book. He rolls himself up in a storm, a whirlwind, I am confident that no one has ever seen the likes of. Can you imagine? You know, Elihu had compared God's voice with thunder, which rattles in the sky. I doubt that he even begun to do justice to the voice coming from the midst of this whirlwind. It is unimaginable for us. Wouldn't it have been nicer for Job had God appeared to him as a sweet songbird? You ever think about that? Wouldn't that have been nice? Like Cinderella had little birds talking to her. That would have been nice. A little songbird to chant to Job that all would be well and everything would be okay. That would have been nice. And God could have done that. You know, he could have come as a still small voice or sent a sweet angel. Done that. Did it later. Or a cherubim to deliver Job an answer. Let me tell you something, ladies. God didn't come to comfort Job. He came to teach him. And he came with great and tremendous power. And it wasn't answers that God was bringing Job. In fact, Job never will get the answers. He will now learn not to ask. You see, God had not arrived to listen. God will now ask Job 77 questions of his own. Concerning not Job's dilemma, but God's nature. He's going to find out how much Job understands about him. And he's going to ask Job to answer the questions. And he will provide Job with some commentary as well, in order that Job might understand. And in the end, he will know that he was totally inadequate to do what he had longed so completely to do, and that was to meet God in court. Or to meet him as an equal. Or to defend anything. Remember in chapter 32 and verse 22, Job says, "Then summon me, and I will answer. Or let me speak, and you reply." That's Job talking to God. Well, Job doesn't get what he asked for. How is a whirlwind for a response? How would you like that as being the response to your request? Will that do? Hard to face that. God comes and he asks three fundamental questions. He asks, "Can you explain my creation? Can you oversee and maintain my creation? And can you subdue and deal with my creation?" Those are the three questions, and we're going to look at those three questions. In other words, if you don't have the qualifications to be God, why do you express yourself as if you were? That's what God asked Job. He immediately asked for his qualifications. Let's see. Do you meet the qualifications? Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately for Job, God's first question pierces his heart in no uncertain terms. He says, Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Immediately, he pierces Job to the very core of his being. Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Isn't that something? God doesn't question the sincerity or the integrity of this righteous man. He only questions Job's ability to explain the ways of God in the world. That's what he asks him to do. You step up here and you tell me how I think. You've got so much to say. Job's assumptions and conclusions about God were not on target at all. Our ability to be truly wise starts only with the knowledge of our ignorance. Isn't it interesting that the wisest people in the world are people who know that they have no way to be wise outside of God? This principle runs solid and rampant throughout the Scriptures. Meekness and humility and submission are absolutely necessary in order to obtain any kind of true wisdom. All right, his final speeches... Job's final speeches were filled with me and I. You know, at the very end, he becomes very self-focused when you look at his addresses to God. Well, God's about to persuade him to think about something else. After his first question put an end to any notion that Job might have anything at all to say, to begin to explain to God, God questions his ability to know what's right. What makes you think that you are right? Look at verse 3. I will question you, and you will answer me. I will question you, and you can teach me, God said. Now just let me say that this is the way this is going to go. It's going to go something like this. God will say, can you do this? No. Have you seen this? No, I haven't. Can you control this? No, I can't. Do you understand this? No, I don't. Have you ever searched out this? No, I haven't. Are you wise enough to do this? No, I'm not. Can you explain this? No. I mean, that's the way this is going to go. Poor Job. And he begins starting with his creation, this world. And he does ask questions. But it wasn't a court date. It wasn't anything like being in court. In chapter 38, in verses 4 through 7, he begins with the creation of the earth. He says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me. You want to speak? Speak. Tell me if you have an understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. You seem to know a lot. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Where God compares himself to a builder who surveys a site, marks off the dimensions, pours the footing, lays the cornerstone, and erects the structure. The earth he compares with that. And his creation was so wonderful that the stars sang in chorus, and the angels shouted for joy. And Job wasn't there to see it. He was nowhere to be seen at that point. Job, you tell me about that. Did this little human who could neither understand or tame or domesticate anything on the earth think that he could domesticate the sovereign God? He can't get a donkey to pay attention to him, God tells him later. You can't get a donkey to do what you want it to. This is a man who's called on creation to make a case for himself in chapter 12. Remember, we talked about that. And he was so in tune with nature. Remember, animals and plants and fish and birds, that they all agree with him. And now God's question is, if you're so in tune with it, you tell me about it. Tell me about how it's made. Tell me about why it works like it does. And over and over and over again, Job says, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know. I don't know how it works. I don't know how it was done. I don't know how it was made. I don't know. And Job, as we do, he looked the part, as did his friends, and he was well-versed in traditions, and he was immaculately correct, and he was perfectly balanced, and he was righteous and upright. What he didn't have the ability to do was touch the surface of understanding God's almighty creation. He was a man. He was creation. God points out later, he said, by the way, I made that behemoth the same time I made you. Same time. In verses 8 through 11, we switch to the seas. The image here switches from building to birth. The seas were knit together in secret behind closed doors, and then they burst forth like a baby coming out of the womb. The seas! They burst forth and issued from the womb. When I made the clouds as their garment, the thick darkness as a swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and I set the bars of the doors, and when I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. They are clothed with clouds and darkness, and their limits are set by God. I love verse 11 when it says, I said to them, you shall come here, but no further. He talks to them like a parent talks to a child. You sit down right here, but don't you dare get up and go over there. He told the seas where they could go. You come this far, and your waves will stop right here. And that's the way I want it. And that's how far you'll go. The seas, the oceans. He talked to them like we talk to our children. And these are the oceans that men are terrified of, that destroy islands of people. Nobody can tame a sea. There's all kinds of tales and stories of the sea and the ocean. And God tells it where to go and where to stop and where to stay and where it can put its waves down. In verses 12 through 15, now the sun, he, God, is the general here. He is the commander. This is military language, commanding his troops, the heavenly host. Incredible stuff. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? And caused the dawn to know its place? Have you told the sun when to rise? That's what he's saying. That it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. Look at this. Job, have you every command of the sun that it may rise when you want it to rise to get rid of the darkness? That's what he says. Chase the darkness away. Have you ever put darkness in its place by bringing in the light and put an end to the evil deeds by shedding light on it? This is amazing stuff. This is Job's day in court. You know, remember, Job had a lot he was going to say. A lot of plans are kind of getting lost in the shuffle. Now there's 11 questions that come that relate to the vast dimensions of the creation. You know, we know more about Job did than the universe. Look at this. NASA can't answer these questions. Poor Job. You know, we think we are something else smart. We can't answer the questions God's asking Job. Job was just standing there. He didn't have a telescope. He didn't even have a pair of binoculars to get a little bit of a glimpse. In verse 16, have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the doors of the shadow of the death? Have you walked along the floors of the sea? You think about that. I love the ocean. It's one of my favorite things. I love to snorkel. I love to see the fish. I love it. I love to stay on top of it and look down and paddle my way over to the little seashore. The depths of the ocean, and God strolls along them. He takes walks down there. The Pacific Ocean, at its greatest depth, is measured 35,810 feet, or 6.78 miles. It's a long way. I bet Job hadn't walked down there, do you think? And then he goes on to talk to Job about the boundaries of space. Voyager 2 spent 12 years going 4.4 billion miles and didn't even get as far as it could have gotten. Poor Job. He says, can you look at the horizons and know how far it is? Verses 19 and 21, God asked Job, can you calculate the reaches from east to west? Are the horizons too big for you to measure? The vastness of this universe, it's mind-boggling to us. We cannot take it in. We cannot take it in. And I think we understand more about not being able to take it in than Job understood about not being able to take it in. He was being told. And then he asked Job if he understood the heights where the snow and the hail were stored until God needed them. Or where God kept his lightning and his winds. Boy, oh boy. Did Job need this to puncture his pride? I imagine he did. Did Job need God to make him understand that it didn't matter what he had to say? God already knew everything he had to say anyway. You think Job may be thinking about his boils now? I doubt it. I imagine he was on his knees, as we should be. Verses 25 through 28. How much do you know about the rain, Job? Look at these verses, 25 through 28. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on the land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy a desolate waste and cause it to spring forth of tender grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice, the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? How much do you know about the rain? Do you know how to plot its course so that it accomplishes God's purposes? Can you tell me about the lightning, where and when to flash? Can you father rain? Put the dew on the land so that it might have the water needed. In verse 26, can you explain why I send rain to places where there is nobody living? Why do I do that? You got an answer for that? Verses 29 through 30, he turns our attention from spring rain to winter hail and frost. If you don't understand how the rain works and who fathered that, do you understand how the ice was born? You know how that happened? Now to the heavens, no taking a breath, no stopping. He just goes full force ahead. To the constellations, to Orion the hunter, the other constellations, the bear and his son. Do you understand the laws that govern their movements, God says to Job? Who controls them and makes them appear in the proper seasons? I'll tell you something. Man can study the stars and the planets, but he cannot control them. God does that, and that's what he tells Job. Verse 33, it's a huge question. The NIV says, can you set up God's dominion over the earth? The New American Standard Version says, or fix their rule over the earth? Job, if you understand so much about heavenly bodies that are thought by some to affect the earth, why don't you use your authority to change your situation? But something. You can read your horoscope every day. And you can read your palm, and you can get those tarot cards, and you can do whatever you want. But God tells Job, if you understand so much about the stars and such, why aren't you using them? He's using very sarcastic language with his servant Job. Verses 34 through 38, the clouds. This is one of my favorite parts of this order that God gives. Can you order the clouds to rain on you? You know, Indians tried that. I mean, all kinds of cultures have tried that. You do the rain dance. And was lightning his servant? Can you take an inventory of the clouds and tip them like jars? You look at this in verses 34 through 38. Can you lift up your voice to the cloud that the abundance of water can cover you? Can you send out lightnings where they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in your mind? Or who has given understanding to your heart? Can you number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can pour out the bottles of heaven? And the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together. You know, this is really interesting language. It's as if God has a storage area or a pantry where he keeps his clouds in jars. That's the way it's personified. And he tips them when he needs them. Can you imagine? Clouds to God are like us going to the pantry to get a spice and use it as we may. That's the power of who Job is talking to. The clouds are kept like inventory in jars for him. Our God is so big. We sing with our children how big he is, and we forget how big he is. Now, creating all things is one aspect of all this, and maintaining it is another. And God's going to shift here from chapter 38 and verse 39 to chapter 39 and verse 30. He says, can you oversee my creation? And the Lord now brings before Job a parade of six beasts. He brings the lioness and the goat and the deer and the wild donkey and the wild ox and the horse. And then he brings five birds forward to him. He brings the raven, the ostrich, the stork, the hawk, and the eagle. And he will one by one talk to Job about these animals. And as he contemplates these creatures, Job answered over and over, no, I do not understand how they live and how to take care of them. God's providence is remarkable. It is remarkable the way the earth works. In his wisdom and power, God supervises the whole universe and makes sure that all of his creation is cared for. And some of it he set forth in motion at creation by giving animals instincts and behaviors that provide them with safety and provide them with a natural way to survive. In Psalms 145 and verse 16, it is stated about God, you open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. You know, we have a difficult time keeping anything going. I can't keep a plant alive at my house. I mean, it's hard for me to keep a potted plant alive. Listen to these questions God will ask Job about his universe and his creation. In verses 39 through 41, did Job know how to feed the lion cubs or the young ravens? Would he even know that they were hungry? Job, would you even sense that they were hungry if you were around them and knew and had a way? Where would you find food for them? God asked him. The ravens would know to find the carcasses left behind by the lions because God taught the birds, even the unclean ravens, how to find food. It's remarkable stuff. 39 through 41. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? Would you be able to feed what I've made? I mean, okay, you certainly couldn't make it. Could you sustain it? Amazing stuff. Could he feed the lion cubs, the ravens? Verses 1 through 4 of chapter 39, he moves forward to the subject of death to birth. Look at the beginning of chapter 39. Do you know the time of the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time that they bear their young? The gestation periods of the goats and the deers, and how the young are born. And how do the little ones grow up safely? Birth and raising the young is not a miracle, like so many in the world talk about and think of it that way and speak of it. It is God's plan. It is not a miracle. When you watch a nature show and they talk about these animals and how amazing it is what it is because that's the way God made it. And that's exactly what he tells Job here. You hear it from his own mouth. I'll tell you why they have babies like they do, and I'll tell you why their babies act like they do. It's because that's the way I made them, so that they would survive. So that my creation can function in this universe. You ever watch the March of the Penguins? That's not a mistake. That's the way God made penguins. We need to tell our children that when they're watching that. In verses 5 through 8, the wild donkey roamed the wilderness freely and refused to be domesticated. It survived without human assistance because God taught it to care for itself. I got to stop. Get a tissue, sorry. That's why. Because it can live without assistance. And the wild ox was another loner in the animal kingdom that he talks about in verses 9 through 12, refusing to yield to the authority of men. You couldn't even keep him in a barn if you wanted to. You can't harness him to the plow. You can't force him to do your threshing. Because I made him that way. And God then turns his description to two birds, the stork, or quite possibly the peacock, and the ostrich in verses 13 through 18. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? For she leaves her eggs on the ground. She warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them. Or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with an understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. Amazing stuff. He asks no questions in this paragraph. He simply reminds Job of the bizarre, weird behavior of these two creatures, and particularly the ostrich, and suggest that perhaps Job could explain that to him. Isn't it amazing? In verse 13, the stork has beautiful wings that work very well and service her greatly. However, all the ostrich can do with her wings is fan the air. You know why? Because I said so. The way I made her. Do you know why I made her like that? I don't. Do you? Job didn't. And she lays her nest in such a vulnerable place that her eggs might be destroyed or eaten by a predator, and she doesn't care. Whatever. So she's labored away, but whatever. Oh, somebody stepped on them. You know why, God says? You know why? Because I made her like that. She seems to not care about her children at all. She loses them. She buries her head in the sand. I'll just go over here and bury my head in the sand, pretend like it didn't happen. And God says, you know why? Because I made her stupid. I made her that way. I gave her no wisdom, and I made her the way I wanted to make her. In verse 18, and though she has no wings that will lift her anywhere, she can run faster than a horse. Incredible stuff. I mean, this is God, our Creator, speaking to us of His creation. It doesn't get better than this. In verses 19 through 25, here comes the horse, an animal greatly admired and valued for its strength and courage. This description here is of a war horse. It's not a farm horse. And can you visualize it prancing and pawing and eager to rush into battle and conquer this great majestic creature that it is? And when he hears the trumpet, he can't stand still. He runs so fast that he seems to devour the ground and eat it up as he goes. It was God, not Job, who made that horse and that strength and that ability that it needed to face the dangers and serve effectively on the field of battle. The nature of the war horse is because of God, not because of man. You know why those horses run like they do in the Kentucky Derby? I can't remember the name of the race. They run like that because God made them have the ability to do so. It's not because man has done something with some kind of farm horse that's made a certain way. God said, I'll tell you why those horses fight like they do. It's because of me. And now the parade ends with two birds, the hawk and the eagle, in verses 26 through 30. Okay, Job, who gave these birds the knowledge to build their nests like they do? Did you do that? And Job says, no, I didn't do it. Eagles build their nests high in the cliffs that God allows them, then the eyesight that they may see their prey way down, way far away. They can spot mice, God says, so that they will survive. God says He made them like that. That's who made them like that. In verses 26 through 30, does the hawk fly by your wisdom? Are you the one that made him the way that he is so that he can survive and spread its wings towards the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold, and there it spies its prey, its eyes observe from afar, its young ones suck up blood where the slain are. There it is. He provides carcasses for the young to eat. Eagles build their nest high in the cliff. They swoop down and capture their prey. Eagles also can find corpses for themselves and their young to feed on. And why is that way? Because God decided that that's the way it would be. It's pretty amazing stuff. And there was no need to go on. No need to name more animals with its own unique abilities and its own unique characteristics. Although He does later, but no need to go into more detail. In fact, Job may not have been able to withstand more detail. He has already fallen so far short in the sufficiency department, as we do. All right. So our eyes are drawn to our dear servant Job. After God ends in chapter 40, moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer. Well, let's see. He had been through the creation of the universe with Job, and he had paraded these animals before him. And taught him just a tad, little bit, teeny tiny bit portion of how they worked and how they fed and how they functioned and how they survived because of the way that he had made them that Job could not even perceive. And now he says, okay, it's time for anybody that has an answer to go ahead and give me an answer. And Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. I have nothing to say. Job's about to be to the point in which God wanted him to be. He's about to be where he wasn't in the first chapter when we met him, when he was a righteous man. God uses language that reflected Job's desire to take God to court and argue his case. Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty, he says. Whoever it was that was wanting to reprove and contend, you can speak now. I'll hear him now. Go ahead, step up. I want to hear him now. Now that I've made clear my creation and who I am. Now that I have presented my case. It's a pretty good case, by the way. Not so bad. But Job has no case to present. His very first words are, "Behold, I am vile." He is guilty of being the created versus the creator. He is guilty of speaking with no understanding. I am vile and insignificant and unworthy. I have no right to debate with the God Almighty. Now Job puts his hand over his mouth, lest he say something that he shouldn't. Romans, the 3rd chapter and verse 19 says, until we are silenced before God, he can't do for us what needs to be done. As long as we are defending ourselves, arguing with God, explaining our inadequacies, and justifying our actions, he cannot do the work that needs to be accomplished in us. If we refuse to stop, to be silent, to allow God to refine us, he simply will just not be able to allow us to be full grown. Job was silenced. Wasn't quite broken. God's going to speak again. But he was at a place of sincere repentance, and he was silent. I'm going to tell you that we must be silent when we come before the throne of God. One of my favorite songs to sing as we come into worship is "The Lord is in His Holy Temple." We have no business going before Him with our mouths open. We are not to explain to God the way things are or should be. He has everything covered. And we move forward now out of the whirlwind again. And the Lord begins to talk again, and he says once again, "Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me." The issue will not now be power, but justice. Now this has been the focus, hasn't it? God is done assuring Job that he can never hope to explain God's creation. He certainly can't sustain it or control it or care for it. In verse 8, "Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you might be justified?" That's kind of what Job had done. Job had said that God was unjust for the way that he had treated him. He said, "You treat me like a criminal, and I haven't done anything." You remember that in chapter 6 and verse 29 and chapter 27 verses 1 through 6? And in a way, he had failed to judge the wicked Job had accused God of in chapter 21 and in chapter 24. Verses 9 through 14 here, God asked Job if he feels like he has the strength and the holy wrath that it takes to judge sinners. Can you imagine? Look at these verses. Verses 9 through 14. Have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder with a voice like His? Then adjourn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty. And disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. God is telling Job, if you can, you be the judge. Can you imagine? Array yourself and bring yourself in majesty before man to humble him and judge him. Something that, of course, we understand no man can do. And that's what God's asking Job to do. If you're so sure of yourself in your judgment of me. Amazing stuff. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together, bind their faces in hidden darkness. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. God said, I tell you what, if you can do that, you will save yourself. You'll be able to save yourself. You won't need me. You don't even need me. Crazy stuff. God asked Job if he feels that he has the strength and the holy wrath to take what that it takes to judge sinners. Go right ahead and bury him, Job. Go ahead. In fact, I'll let you practice on two of my creatures, he's going to say. The behemoth and Leviathan. Now, I think these two creatures that we're going to talk about here are similar, if not exactly, the hippopotamus and the crocodile. It's hard to know from their titles and from what they're named here, but we'll talk about that a bit later on. Now, if Job has succeeded in subduing them, then he would qualify to execute judgment, God says. Let me take these two creatures and see if you would be able to subdue them, to do anything with them. In verses 15 through 24, the behemoth, or probably similar to a hippo or a water buffalo or something like that. In verses 15, look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you, by the way, made him on the day that I made you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and he has power in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like cedar, and his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs are bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus tree, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh, and the lotus trees cover him with their shade, and the willows on the brooks around him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he's not disturbed. He's confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. This is a tough booger. I'm telling you. This is a tough guy. Behemoth in the Hebrew means super beast, literally. It's interesting because my family and I, we took our children on a safari in Africa in the Mesa Mara, Serengeti, when the wildebeest were migrating. And one of the days that we were there, we went and had a lunch by the hippo pond. And we were kind of up on a little cliff kind of thing. And below us was the river. And we were in a little area of the river that kind of was kind of like a little lake area. And it was filled, absolutely filled with hippopotamuses and crocodiles. They cohabit together. It's another reason why I think that these may be the two animals that God is talking about here. Well, hippopotamuses are terribly mean. And so our guides were there with us. Now, let me just tell you, they're about half the size of me, just so you know. So it's a little scary. But, and, you know, they're little bitty men. And they have little tiny, you know, bows and arrows. And of course, I knew about this, that they can't even pierce the nose with it. So I was a little worried. But they're terribly mean, the hippopotamuses are. And the guides are much more afraid of a hippo than they are a crocodile. It's interesting. And the hunters would tell us, the guides would say, you know, you need to be really careful not to get, of course, I didn't have any problem keeping me away. But I had my teenage son with me, who, of course, was Superman, so we had to watch him. But anyway, it was really interesting. And they talked to us about what these animals would do. And they said, well, you know, aren't hippopotamuses vegetarians, which is what this says. They eat the grass. You know, hippopotamuses feed off of things that come down the banks of the rivers, which is what God tells us. So it's nice that it all works out. So the monkeys play in the trees. They knock the branches down. They go into the water, and the hippopotamuses eat them. And I said, well, it's funny because they doesn't seem like they'd want me And he said, well, they don't want you. They grab you and they drown you and then the crocodiles eat you. Isn't that interesting? It's kind of what God said. Now, some of these gentlemen had rifles as well. I don't know. But anyway. But we did as we were told. But it's interesting about these animals. And God asked Job. He said, you know, really, actually, if you could subdue a hippopotamus, maybe you really could judge. Maybe you would be a good judge. Now, I'll just tell you that the way I understand it, rivers in Africa are covered with these animals. And the way I understand it is, and he's talking about the Jordan. And the way I understand it is that the rivers in northern Africa and the Nile and all had all kinds of hippopotamuses and crocodiles in them. Job understood what God was saying to him. He understood the power of these animals. And he understood that they would kill him. All right. Well, it makes more sense to me now that I've been on this trip. I didn't eat a lot that day. It's a little scary. I have a hefty respect for animals and their habitats. But it is an interesting thing what God's telling, that the strength surpassed anything Job could imagine. In verse 15, God reminds Job that he made that animal on the day that he made himself. And yet, he made them very different. They're not anything alike. He eats the grass, and he's strong and powerful. Job eats fine foods and is weak and vulnerable and unable to fight a hippo. Think about how different we're made. The hippo has a powerful body, he says, with strong under muscles, bones like iron rods, while man's body is weak in comparison and easily damaged. The hippo lounges in the river. He just sits there. You know, this is say the waters rage beneath him that would sweep a man away and drown him. And the hippopotamus just stands there, just lounging around, and you know, amazing. God said, that's the way I made him. He feeds on vegetation that washes down the river. Now, Job, can you capture and subdue that great creature? Because if you can, I'll let you judge. Look at chapter 41, Leviathan, the crocodile. The transliteral Hebrew for this is to twist or writhe. And have you ever seen a crocodile on the shows, you know, killing its prey? That's the way they kill their prey. People used to describe this word as sea monsters, supposedly inhabited the Mediterranean. It may be different than a crocodile. We don't know. My new son-in-law, we met with them the night before they left. And he said, well, so how are you liking the book of Job? He said, I like that Leviathan. I said, yeah. I said, I think it's a crocodile. He said, no, it's a dragon. I said, okay, well, you need to grow up. But I don't know what it was. The description of it is similar to a crocodile. Crest dragon kind of looks like that too. Psalms 104 in verses 23 through 26. This same word appears, and it seems to be more like whales or dolphins, to see something that lives in the sea. The Jews use this word to describe their enemies in Isaiah, especially Egypt in Psalms 74. Revelation 12 and 19 refers to Satan as that old Satan, which is the same word. It's not a nice creature. In mythology, it is a many-headed monster that ruled the waters and feared no man. Lee's little boy, John, he was in second grade, and they talked about the Leviathan at school one day. And you know how kids are, you know, they take everything in and to heart. And his teacher said, now, you know, this is a creature of mythology. And he said, no, it's not. It really existed. It's in the Bible. And she told Lee later, she said, is it really? And Lee said, yeah, it is. She said, oh, wow, I didn't have any idea. It's real. Now, it may not have had many heads. I mean, that may be depicted by a man. But God says, can you catch it or capture the Leviathan? When you fish in the water and you draw that out, what do you do with that? What do you do when you've captured a crocodile, God says? Look at this. Can you draw out a Leviathan with a hook? You're just fishing along the banks and you pull one of those out of the water. Or you snare his tongue with a line, which you lower. Can you put a reed through his nose? Can you tame him? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? This is God talking to Job. Amazing. Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet for him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Amazing. If you catch him, what will you do with him? God says. What will you do with a captured crocodile? In that song, never smile at a crocodile. Never tip your hat or make him stay a while. You don't mess with a crocodile. Peter Pan knows that. That's a dilemma. Of course, not to God, because God made him. You see, God can make a covenant with the crocodile if he wants to. That's his point. Or he can make him go away. Or he can do whatever he wants to with him. In verses 1 through 11, you can't make a pet out of him, no matter how agreeable he may seem. Merchants aren't going to want to buy him. You can't sell him. You pull him out of that water, you're not going to get anybody else to take him. That's what God says to Job. You'd be in a fix if you pulled one of those out. You're going to try to train him, do tricks for you? You'll quit in a hurry. God says, I'll tell you what will happen. You'll quit and you will never try it again. This is amazing stuff. Verses 10 through 11, God draws a particular conclusion. If you can't come to grips with the crocodile, how will you ever be able to stand before me? Look at this, verses 10 through 11. No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. You couldn't even begin to do something with this crocodile if you did come near it. How in the world are you going to come before me? God gave a practical description of this great creature's mighty limbs and fierce teeth and strong jaws. In verses 18 through 21, when the crocodile churns up the river and blows out the water, the sun reflects on the vapor and it looks like fire and smoke from a dragon's mouth. Hence the dragon. 22 through 24, his armor is so strong that he can't go anywhere with fear. Amy, what time do we go to? Do you know? Are we past? 10 after. Okay. This chapter closes in verses 25 through 34 with a description of the Leviathan's anger and courage. People flee from him in fear, but he does not flee from them. Verses 26 through 29, God named 8 different weapons that the Leviathan laughs at and treats like pieces of straw or rotten wood. This is the Creator discussing His creation. He knows every minute detail. You ever talk to somebody who builds something, who paints something, who writes something? They know every detail. This is the Creator of the crocodile explaining to his other creation about this marvelous creature. And just as this creature fears nothing around him, he also fears nothing below him, because his underside is protected with a covering that is so sharp that it pierces pottery. And that's what verse 30 says. You read this tremendous description of this animal. He fears no enemy on land or on water, for he makes the water to foam like the ingredients in a pharmacist's mixing pot. It's that description there. And when he swims through the water, the wake looks like white hair of an old man. Just an incredible description of this creature. Well, Job knew that he had been beaten. And there was just no way that he could argue his case with God. In fact, there is no case. And that's what he says when he quotes God's own words in chapter 42. And Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me. Well, there was no case, and there is none for us before the Creator. We are His creation. We are His. We belong to Him. He knows everything. It is interesting, God, and how He takes notice of us and details of our life. I think about that a lot, you know, the more probably that you see in life and the more you go. And we're just one in so many. And yet He doesn't forget us. He doesn't leave us. He cares deeply for us, as He did for Job. But make no mistake about it. He runs everything. And He knows the way that it all goes. And there is a reason for all this. And I think that's why it's so easy for me to dismiss so much in the world. It's really not my concern about space. I'm interested, vaguely. I think we know so little compared to what there really is out there to know. And I love nature shows. I really do. And I love, but it just verifies and solidifies what I already know. And that is that this creation is more incredible than we can take in. And we just have absolutely no way to touch it or tame it or sustain it or maintain it. And God takes care of all that. He does all that. And He does that for us. He maintains and sustains for us. And He is interested in us. And He does know what is happening to us. And we don't have to plead our case before Him. He already knows our case. Well, there was nothing more for Job to say. And we're going to look in the next hour. The bell's about to ring, and we're going to look in the next hour at the end of the matter, and we'll look at the last part of chapter 42, and then we'll do a few questions or comments or whatever at the end.